Welcome back to Farm Foundations, the podcast where we dig deep into the world of homesteading and sustainable living. I'm one of three co-hosts, Tyler Lowry, joined by my friends, Bo Pruck and Joe Grissom.
Hey there, folks.
Howdy, everyone.
In today's episode, we're going to dive down the rabbit hole that is a food label. But before we get into that, let's take a quick look back at the updates from the past week with our weekend review. Joe, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Had a great week. Weather's turned good here in Purdy. It's a beautiful time of year. Starting to warm up and you can feel summertime coming. But did pretty good this week. We had a farm visit, which was very exciting. We might talk more about that later. But opportunity to get down and get your hands dirty and smell soil and understand the difference between dirt and soil. We built some soap molds out of some recycled barn wood. And oddly enough, after that, we had a table saw safety class because Joe cut his fingers pretty good. We butchered and packaged some meat, and I should tell you that there was also some cut fingers during the butcher class that went on, and I made fun of people, and I think the table saw accident was my just desserts for making fun of folks in the butcher room. We picked dried and packaged mullein for use in cold and flu season. I mowed some yard, fed my baby goat 4 times a day, and we had a baby pigeon today, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, the pigeon's exciting. I know you've been working really hard for a while trying to get the pigeons to produce, and that's definitely some exciting news. And new baby goat this week, yes?
Yes, Sunday after church, we picked up a new baby goat. Her name is Atlanta.
And that brings us up to how many goats now?
5 goats.
5 goats. So we're really growing that herd. Bo, what have you been up to this week?
So we did some infrastructure stuff. We are running new water line to places in our garden so we can put soaker hoses in. We're probably getting pretty close to coming out of the wet season here, so we're going to make sure that we can keep all the vegetables watered. We moved quail from the incubator over to the brooder pen. So we're going to have 3 more quail that we're going to be raising to butcher. And other than that, I was involved in the butchery that we did this last weekend, and that took us all day, and then we stuck most of the meat into the freezer today to finish it up. So it's been mostly maintenance this week, just building infrastructure for the homestead.
I know for me, butchering was a big day this week. I mean, that was an all-day project, and there was, the 3 of us, plus Katie and Liz and Morgan and Mason, and we had Steve there. I think that's everybody. But that was definitely a big project that took up a lot of time. This week, I've been making quite a bit of soap. I've got, as Joe mentioned, we built some soap molds and been working pretty hard on that. And that's kind of what my weeks looked like. Butchering was really the big project this week.
I think we had maybe the best hamburger in my entire life, did it?
Oh, it was fantastic. Lunch in the butcher room was awesome. And if you saw our video on Facebook, I don't know, we had a little bit of fun as well while we were out there trying to pronounce
Worcestershire
sauce. Yeah, that was definitely a little bit of fun in the butcher room around lunchtime, but those were some fantastic burgers.
And fresh eggs and bone marrow. Oh, it was amazing.
Fantastic. Well, as we move on into today's topic, we're going to talk about food labels and how do we interpret food labels. And this really comes to us. We had a listener reach out to us and ask some questions about certified organic and what does certified organic mean. So kind of in response to that, you know, this is a big rabbit hole that we can go down, but we're going to talk about food labels today to hopefully answer some of those questions. So as we move into our first segment today, let's just talk just kind of a basic overview of food labels, and let's just start off with an explanation of what are some required elements on food labels. I know you guys listening can't see what we're looking at. I went up to the pantry and we grabbed several different cans of various produce, and there's a lot of different things on these labels. Joe, if you want to kick us off, what are the required things on a food label to get us going?
So, you know, food labels are there because we had some really unscrupulous practices way back, a couple of generations back. And things would say, oh, we have a canned meat. Well, you know, the question then is, what is meat? You know, in that generation, folks assumed it was either pork or beef, but sometimes canned meat was a combination thereof. So the government kind of came in and said, we need to be very clear about what it is that we're selling. And so today we have this little bar or box that I call it, that basically says what you can expect. And that is, of course, your calories, number of calories per serving. And remember, when our country was evolving, we were a very different population than we are today. Those in coming out of post-depression era nutrition, people were starving. And still today, we can say that in the other developing countries, they still are. They're calorie deficient. So today we want to say, you know, in those days, we said it's important to know how many calories you're getting, to know whether it's a calorie-dense food, if it's something that's going to help your family or benefit your family. Today, our population is far different. We want to make sure that we understand that a serving size is far less than what we suspect. So, for example, when we sit down in the morning with a bowl of cereal, typically that's 4 or 5 servings. So we want to be very clear. So this little box of nutritional facts is going to have your calories. It's going to have your fat, cholesterol, sodium, carbohydrates, and your protein. And again, it's always going to have your 5 essential nutrients, which is your protein, fat, vitamins and minerals, carbohydrates, and water. So how much water? So you can have something floating around in a whole bunch of water, and you get a 16-ounce can, and it's got 2 beans in it. It's going to, that bar graph is going to tell you how much density is in that can.
What about you, Bo? When you think of a food label, what are some things that you expect to see when you're looking at something at the grocery store?
So this episode is going to go down as Bo's most worthless episode that he contributed to, because I've not spent a lot of time looking at food labels. I'm looking at a can of whole kernel corn with no salt added, and I can honestly tell you, I don't think I've ever looked at a food label off a can of corn. So I have been on some diets at times and, you know, maybe counted calories, but I know very, very little about what we're looking at here. It looks like one thing that maybe Joe didn't mention is the percent of your daily value, to keep track of percentages of the daily value on there. But usually I'm just looking at the front cover to see if I'm grabbing whole kernel corn or that nasty pureed corn that people eat.
So really, you know, for you, when you look at a label, you're looking at the front of the can. You're not looking at the back of the can. We're looking at the nutrition facts and the serving sizes. And another important thing that's kind of included there is an ingredient list. I'm looking at pinto beans here, and it says the ingredients are pinto beans and water. So it's a pretty short ingredient list. But
I've got corn and water on mine.
I know some of these canned things can have some scary sounding preservatives, and maybe some scary preservatives as well, depending on what can we pick up. So when we look at a food label, the big key things, we're looking at serving size, calories, nutrients, and an ingredient list. So what's the importance of understanding this? What do we need to be thinking about when we look at a food label? Joe, you want to kick us off there?
Well, there's a lot of things that you should look at. In my opinion, one of them is calories. You know, what is the quality? Is that particular can of corn going to be from fresh corn or some aged corn that has a bunch of sugar added? You know, if you think, oh, I should go buy some sweet corn, remember corn processes very poorly. Fresh corn 3 days later tastes like mud. We all look forward to having corn on the cob fresh out of the garden, but sweet corn 3 days later is terrible. Why? Well, it's the varieties, it's the processing, it's the heat, it's the trucking, it's the filth that comes with it. Sweet corn in a big commercial application is processed with machinery and it's dirty. So they've got to wash it 3 times, and that washing takes out the sugars. Food miles, I'm looking at a can here of sliced peaches. This one particularly says, and what's important to me is it says Ingredients is yellow clingstone peaches with pear juice from concentrate. So that means some pears were processed somewhere. It doesn't tell us anything about that. So if you think about a can of peaches, they're floating in a liquid. It's this particular liquid's not even peach, it's pear. And it says it's got added citric acid to regulate acidity, which is a preservative issue. It says it's a product of China. So when I look at foods that I'm buying in the grocery, food miles is extremely important to me. Here's a can of food that's made by a communist nation that really wouldn't care if Americans were healthy or sick. I don't know that they have our best interests in heart. So the idea that in my pantry, I found a product of China is a little unsettling for me. Obviously, when we bought this, we weren't paying attention. It also says this contains pits and or pit fragments. It says after opening, refrigerate these contents in a different container, proper glass or plastic. So what's that tell us about the quality of the can that it's in? So not on, we're not even talking about the food now. We're talking about this can's probably going to rust or oxidate the minute we open it. So there's a lot of things that I like to look at, but I think maybe I'm probably not a good guy to ask because I have a very suspicious mind anyway.
You talked a little bit about food miles there. I just did a quick search from Southwest Missouri, which is where we are, to China. We're looking at about 7,229 miles, and I don't know that you can get much higher on your food miles than that.
That's about as far away as unless they're growing in space somewhere.
Now the next question is, these peaches are, it says, in 100% pear juice from concentrate. So how far did that pear juice travel to the factory where the peaches were processed? So there's probably way more miles on that. That could have been a U.S. product that was shipped to China.
And then shipped back.
So it means 7,000 could be 14,000 miles. And if that's the case, then shame on me for ever letting this in my house.
Bo, I know you said that you may not be able to contribute much, but as we talk a little bit about food miles, I know you're in the trucking industry. What do you see as far as cleanliness of trucks and cleanliness of transport when we're transporting these things? Is that something that's an issue? Is it something that's paid close enough attention to? What's that look like?
So, I mean, I think it's like anything else. You know, it depends on the company. Right now, trucking companies are declaring bankruptcy all over the United States because of the influx of people that decided to get into the business or double or triple the size of their business during the COVID times, whenever freight was really good. So we're seeing, you know, rates are just dropping into a dangerously low level. So, you know, right now the products that are going to be hauled might not be hauled in quite as clean of a van. You know, we're approaching, you know, harvest season. You know, we're not too far away from that in the California area where, you know, people will pile in there by the thousands into the fields where, you know, a lot of this product's going to be, you know, basically picked and carted over to the truck and then loaded up. But we've done that several times. You know, you have a vented van that rolls in there and they load you up. But they really do a pretty good job of inspecting your trailer before they get loaded, especially in California, which California, you know, has a huge, huge harvest season for us in trucking. It's huge. So, you know, people pile in there by the tens of thousands and, you know, stuff's going to slip through the cracks, though. You know, that's always concerned me, you know, when my drivers send us pictures of, you know, an entire van just stacked on the floor. You know, most of this isn't coming on pallets a lot of the times. You know, they are literally just putting this on the floor of a trailer that could have hauled batteries the load before. So there's a lot that goes into that. And again, they do a fantastic job of inspecting trailers. You know, we have seen that many times. But just looking at the label, again, I've got some whole kernel corn here. And I'm looking at stuff like sodium and carbs, which is, you know, something that people highly, you know, try to stay away from, I think, on a lot of fronts. And half of all the sodium and all the carbs in this entire can is in the liquid. So they have an undrained and a drained column, and half of the sodium and carbs are in the liquid. If you drain it, you're cutting your sodium and your carbs in this can in half. So that's kind of interesting. And then I would say under the ingredients, you know, me and you both said, I don't remember what you had, but we both had two ingredients.
Pinto beans as well.
Pinto beans and water, right? So I've got corn and water. So right on the surface, I'm saying that if I was going to open a can of corn from the store, this would be a pretty good can. Just by looking at the ingredients. I'm not seeing, you know, a ton of preservatives listed, a ton of flavors. This is no salt added, so there's no salt in there. I literally have two ingredients, corn and water. So just by looking at that, I would say if I was going to choose a can of corn, this one right here would be a pretty good one.
I don't mean to beat a dead horse on the trucking. When I worked in a little bit of commercial ag when I was younger, one of the things that really bothered me was that a rejected load didn't mean that that food wasn't going to make it into your food stream. A rejected load meant we were going to take it back, we were going to divvy it up, and we were going to blend it, and we were still going to try and sneak that in into the food stream. So when we have, you know, corn that's got mold in it, or we've got corn that's got any kind of fungus, it's whatever, it doesn't test right, it's got alpha toxins, moisture's not right, whatever, when there's an issue and that load gets rejected, you know, as a normal person, I would think, oh, that was a rejected load, that's bad corn, we're not going to eat that. But instead, what we're going to do is we're going to take that, we're going to ship it back, we're going to divvy it up, and we're going to try and hide it in a good load that tests well, and we're going to sneak that into the food stream. And that
little
was
bits at a time.
Little bits at a time.
I think people don't understand that a lot. We haven't had a ton of loads rejected over the years for any reason, but what I've always found interesting about that is, if a load gets rejected anywhere, 50% of the time, I'm going to say, they don't have you take that load to the dump. It's still in their warehouse. So everybody has to ask themselves, what is happening to that product? Why are they saying this load is no longer viable as a product for us? But we're going to keep it in this warehouse, and then it disappears and it goes away. And, you know, they get to cut costs because they'll call the shipper and say, you guys didn't package this right. It has the wrong label on it. The outside of the plastic bottles are scratched. And then they get to, you know, probably triple or quadruple their profit by doing exactly what you said. They're going to put that one scratched bottle in a 12 pack of unscratched bottles and sell it at full price. And there's a lot of, you know, that goofy kind of stuff that goes on that people don't have any idea about.
Dilution is the solution.
That's one of the things that really bothers me about commercial ag. And, you know, when you produce it on your homestead, you know that that's not happening. But when you go to buy something from the store, you don't know what's been blended into that. You don't know where it came from. You don't know what problems are there. And that's really concerning.
And that's a good segue into the label of certified organic.
So, yeah, it was a perfect segue. So as we come in and we're addressing some of those listener questions we had, so what are some common label claims that we see? I know on all of these cans here, most of them, like, I'm looking at a can of pinto beans here. So right at the top, pinto beans, no salt added, fat-free, gluten-free, excellent source of fiber. Bo, what have you got in your hand?
My whole kernel corn is no preservatives, non-GMO, grown in the USA on a nice pretty little stamp on the side of it.
Joe, looks like you've got some green beans. What are some things that you see on the face of that label that are kind of trumped up?
Well, first of all, it says fresh cut, which makes me laugh. Because you can't cut a non-fresh green bean, you know, they turn to mush fairly quickly. So of course it was fresh cut. And then it says no preservatives, and I don't see any on there. Non-GMO. Non-GMO makes me laugh because there are no such thing as GMO green beans. There's very few GMO products out there. So of course there's no GMO in this particular can because they're green beans and not soybeans.
What about corn? Is that the same way with the GMO?
Not in sweet corn. So when we talk about GMO products, it's a very limited list. We're talking some wheat, we're talking corn, we're talking soy. Those are the two biggest ones. But as we break it down, and by the way, that means Roundup Ready. So corn or soy, either one, is a genetically modified organism in that we manipulated the DNA in that it can tolerate glyphosate.
Really?
So when we talk about non-GMO potatoes, we don't have a GMO potato. When we talk about non-GMO green beans, there's no such thing. Nobody has ever made a green bean that is a GMO variety. So this company here says non-GMO, and I say, well, no shit. Because you don't have you've not put the technology into that yet.
Same thing with chicken, right? When they say hormone free, we outload hormones in chickens.
So a chicken is, 60 days old max. The average age of a chicken is 53 days in the United States. So why would you give it hormones if you're going to kill it in 53 days? It doesn't need to grow any faster than it's already growing because it's going to die at 53 days average. So some of these things here are just to rope consumers into thinking that they're buying a better quality product.
Just a sales pitch.
That's it. So and this can here is a Del Monte quality, fresh cut green bean, but it says non-GMO. There's no such thing as a GMO green bean, but they put that label on there and it differentiates and it makes people feel like this Del Monte is a better can than the value can.
So on the corn deal, then, that's why you can see farmers with the big spray rigs running through the corn spraying. And if you look at the fields, there's no weeds in those fields. They're pouring Roundup of some kind directly onto that. It's not hurting the corn.
You're exactly right.
But it's still on the corn we're eating.
You're exactly right. And because corn is used not only in the corn, the ag corn, the corn that is in most of the fields we see throughout the United States, is not only used in animal feed, but it's used in ethanol production. It's used in cellophane type production. So if it's not in your food, it's in your packaging. So if you look at the little window on your monthly bills, the little plastic window that covers your name address, that's a cornstarch type product. So the GMO corns are used in about 80-90% of the products you see in the grocery store. So let's go to Walmart, take a look at what you have. GMO corn is there in everything. If it's not in the package, if it's not in the food you eat, it's in the packaging that food comes in. So it's in a very important part. Now, I think it's fair, just for the record, Joe Grissom doesn't want to eat GMOs. But if it weren't for GMOs, the weather conditions we had in 2012 were dry enough and windy enough with El Nino that we would have had the worse Dust Bowl conditions than we had in the 30s. So get your head around that. So prior to GMOs in our country, we had to cultivate our corn with open tillage. And open tillage is really hard on the environment. And if you get a drying wind, it depletes the carbon, it takes the soil away, and we end up with Dust Bowl conditions. So although GMOs are scary and something that I don't necessarily want to eat, we would have had a global famine in 2012 if it weren't for GMOs. So I want to be very clear about that. I am not a fan of GMOs. But the fact of the matter is they reduce the number of times that we have to go across our acreage. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of scenario. I don't want to feed it to my family, but I work my ass off to make sure that I can feed my family the food that I want them to eat. But globally, there's not enough people that can do what I do. So GMOs, are they bad? I got to tell you that in my heart of hearts, I'm scared of them. But in my brain, I look at what they've done for our globe, and GMOs are an important part of our future.
Well, when we talk about GMOs and specifically like Roundup Ready corn or beans, I think an important conversation to have is maybe we need to place a little bit more responsibility on the farmer as well. Because in some of the operations I've seen, you know, we may have an Roundup ready corn, but are we applying that chemical in an appropriate manner? And I don't think that that's happening in a lot of instances.
I agree.
So we may have a corn that can tolerate Roundup, but that doesn't mean that we should dump three times the amount of Roundup on our field than what is called for. I don't even know that we should be dumping the normal dose of Roundup
on our
field.
Agreed.
Maybe we should, you know, in medicine, what we do, there's a term called titrate to effect. So we medicate somebody, but we're only going to give them enough medicine to see the effect that we want. And once we see that effect, we're going to stop putting it on there. But as farmers, what do? We take that jug of glycophosphate and we dump it in there and we say, oh, yeah, that's enough. Oh, glug, glug, glug. Oh, maybe a little bit more. Oh, just to be sure, glug, 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 there's a little extra and that'll cover us. And I don't think that that's necessarily appropriate. We run into the same problems with, you know, broad spectrum antibiotics and all the problems that that creates. If we're a little bit wiser with our application and we're a little bit more conservative with our application, I think we can eliminate a lot of those problems, or at least mitigate some of those risks. But I think that's a big problem that we see in commercial ag these days.
I wouldn't disagree, Tyler. I think you're spot on.
As we move down our list, one of the things on my can of pinto beans here, it says gluten-free. Legumes, naturally gluten-free.
Don't have gluten.
No gluten. So as we kind of move on in the conversation, how do we differentiate between marketing terms and regulated terms? You know, do I need that gluten? Is that gluten-free there because it needs to be there and because it's regulated? Or is it just there as a marketing scheme to get me to pick up this can and take it home?
Well, if you're asking for my opinion, I will tell you that every single thing you see on a can is probably a double dose of BS. And the fact of the matter is, when we talk about things and different claims that are made on a can or on a label of any kind, you cannot believe it. Just don't believe it, guys. It's that important. If you do not know the farmer, you can't be assured that it's meeting your standards or your idea of quality. So, you know, when we talk about things, and hopefully, Tyler, you'll allow me to jump into it, but when we talk about labels made on eggs, for example, let's just talk about eggs for just 1 second. Some of the claims that you might see on eggs, of course, are organic. White, brown, or blue eggs. The grade of the eggs, A, AA, or B. The size of the eggs, medium, large, or extra large. Cage free. Free range. Vegetable diet. Certified humane, non-GMO verified. That one always makes me laugh, by the way. Non-GMO verified, which means not only, you know, there's no such thing as a Franken chicken. Regenerative is a big one. I'm a big fan of regenerative, but even that's been bastardized. Antibiotic free. You know, again, when we talk about the age of a chicken, and we say it's antibiotic free, it's because he dies before he has the time to get sick. We kill him before he can get sick and die. We kill him as a young bird. He's not even fully feathered when we kill a broiler. Locally sourced. Well, no kidding, because we can't ship chickens all over the globe. It costs too much. We need cheap chickens, so chickens are grown a lot closer to their sources. Pasture raised. Natural. Farm fresh. You know, farm fresh makes me laugh. Do you want farm not fresh? Yeah, they're going to put these labels on there, and that's so vague that you can't be assured that any of these things are meeting your idea of quality. Pasture raised means that they cut a door and allow the chickens to go outside if they want to.
As we talk about like free range chickens, I've got a little bit of experience there. I think we've talked about it a little bit on previous podcasts, but I worked on an organic chicken farm, and it was cage-free, free-range, organic. And I think I talked a little bit about some of the issues there. But when we talk specifically about free-range, so to qualify for free range, they had a, I think it was a 600 foot chicken house. And at half house, there's a door on every chicken house. And they would open that door during the day. And you might have 200 chickens out of that house come out. I mean, there's thousands of birds in this house. You may have 200 come out and wander around in this little free range cage. So one of the things I highlighted and we kind of laughed about on a previous podcast was that chickens are so territorial that if you have a rooster that flogs you, the worst thing you can do to that rooster is pick him up and carry him to the other end of the house, because as soon as you set him down, he's going to run back right to that, you know, maybe 10-foot square area that you picked him up from, and he's going to get his ass kicked all the way back. So when I think about a free-range chicken, and I think about him being in a 600-foot house, and I know how territorial these chickens are, if I open that 4-foot door at half house, and I've got 200 birds that come out, that means I've got 200 free-range birds, and I've got 10,000 regular birds. Really, just slapping that free range label on there really doesn't accomplish much, except for maybe 2% of your chicken population in that house. And it just makes me laugh.
The birds just can't hardly leave their feed. They want to stay closer to the feed line, and to go outside isn't something that ever enters their mind. I mean, we think about chickens like having a third grader's mindset. And as a third grade kid, we all want to get out for recess. Chickens don't think that way. They want to stay closer to the feed pan. So why would they go outside? Moreover, why would they risk getting picked off by a hawk, a wolf, or a grizzly bear? That's the big old bad world out that door. Mm-hmm. They just don't go out.
Well, that's another issue that when you know, I don't want to get too deep into it, but when you have free-range birds, you've got to be cognitive of disease, because you're exposing your birds to wild fowl, the wild birds, and you really have an opportunity for disease exchange there. So if you're not paying attention to your flock, if you're not managing that correctly, you can really have some big issues there as well.
Well said.
So I just looked up, he mentioned locally sourced, and the deal I just pulled up here on my phone real quick was you can label something locally sourced if it's within 400 miles of where you're selling it. So to put that in perspective, here in Southwest Missouri, that's south of Dallas, Texas.
Nashville
is right at 400 miles. And they will call that locally sourced, which is, I mean, you have to drive through two other states before you get to Texas here. You know, I mean, that is nowhere close to locally.
In my mind, when I think local, like for us particularly, we're right in the middle of like Joplin, Springfield, and Rogers, Fayetteville, Arkansas area. Yeah. So when I think local, if I buy something that's locally sourced, I expect it to come from somewhere in that circle. Mm-hmm. If it's West Plains, I'm not calling that local. If it's St. Louis, Kansas City, I'm not calling that local. Yeah. But 400 miles, that's crazy.
And see, guys, for my family on my farm here at Farm Foundations, locally sourced means the 100-yard meal.
Yeah.
And we try very hard to say, you know, it's about 100 yards from here to my pig pen, here to my chicken coops. Guys, we need to work very hard at trying to have a 100-yard meal on the regular basis.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about some common claims, organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, natural. There's a host of other claims. Let's talk a little bit about some certification labels. So we've got USDA organic. So that's an actual certification. We've got fair trade. We've got certified humane. Is there a difference between some of these other claims and an actual certification, and does that make much of a difference?
So that's a really great question, and I like to break it down. So let's just, for example, think if it says organic, it says certified organic, then your first question would be certified by whom? So the USDA has one, but if you're in California, California has their own. So in the state of California, if you want to sell an organic product, it has to be approved organic by the state of California. There's a lot of other organic certification bodies, for example, OMRI. And you can say, well, this particular can of green beans is certified organic by OMRI. But then again, the state of California says, well, we don't care. If it's not certified organic by us, you can't sell it in the state of California. So every state, every region has their own. Some states say, oh, if it's an OM, OMRI certified is good enough because they don't have their own certification body. But California has really kind of bumped up the standards. And of course, with that, we can say they want their taxes. They want their fees. It's very difficult to sell anything certified or organic anywhere without the state of California's approval. So it's the toughest one to get. Other certification bodies are pretty simple. So it really just kind of depends on what your standards are. And quite frankly, when we talk about some of those standards, most organically approved agricultural practices aren't good enough for me. So what does that mean? You would think that if your green beans are certified organic, you would feel like there's no spray on it. But the fact of the matter is they have to spray them. Or apples. Let's talk about apples. That's a good one. You have to spray apples on a regular basis. And a fungicide, a pesticide, or an herbicide, anything. Remember, side means death. Like suicide means death. Any biocide, bio meaning life, anything that's a biocide is a toxin. Most organic certifications will allow some sort of a biocide in their production. So, for example, the apple producers say, we can't produce apples without a fungicide. Certainly not an apple that we'll ever sell. So they use a more benign product, but now they have to spray it with four times the volume. So some of the man-made chemicals, maybe they spray that apple once during its production cycle. But a naturally approved, like neem oil, for example, naturally approved or carbaryl, some of those toxins may have to be sprayed, 10 times in the course of the apple's production, depending on the weather conditions. So having an organic certification doesn't necessarily mean that you're not getting chemicals. In fact, it may mean you're getting more chemicals than normal. So you need to be very suspicious. And the fact of the matter is, any of these certification labels have been bastardized by corporate America. Mm-hmm. And that's, I hate to sound abrupt and hateful, but corporate greed has ruined my confidence in consumer products. And it should have ruined yours as well. There's no way that you should have any kind of a comfort level with any certification body or with any label that you see on a can of food. The only way that you can ensure that those animals or vegetables or products are being raised and processed in a manner that fits your needs is to know your farmer, period. There's no other way around it, guys. And that sounds a little bit strong, but the fact of the matter is corporate greed has ruined it for all of us.
I think it's largely cosmetic. When we talk about apples, we produced apples for thousands. I mean, the entire lifetime of the planet, we were producing apples. Well, I won't say that, apples had to develop and all that, but we had apples for hundreds of years before we had fungicides. Fungicides give us a pretty apple, but they're not necessary to produce an apple that will feed our family. If we're comfortable eating an ugly apple, then I think we're fine. And I think that's a mindset change for us as consumers. We say, you know what, I don't want all these chemicals. I don't want all this bullshit in my food. Sometimes you're going to have to eat an ugly carrot.
Exactly right.
To get away from the chemicals and all the crap that we're putting in this food.
And they just don't sell as well. So when we go, and here's a neat story. I had a conversation with a guy in eastern Nebraska once who raised about 12 acres of tomatoes. And you all know I'm a tomato fanatic. 12 acres of tomatoes is a lot of damn tomatoes. Lots of tomatoes. And I said, well, who do you sell them to? I thought maybe he'd sell them to, a Heinz or somebody that bought a lot of tomatoes. He said, no, we sell them all to Farmers Market in Lincoln, Nebraska, which fascinated me. And I said, well, wow, what's your favorite tomato? What do you sell the best? What is the tomato? And he looked at me and he said, the biggest one. I said, what do you mean? He said, consumers don't give a crap about flavor. They care about looks. He said, the biggest tomato is the one that they'll buy every time. And he said, if we've got some really shitty tomatoes, we put a big, fat, beautiful tomato on top of the basket, and we'll sell the whole basket based on that one big tomato. He also had a couple acres of strawberries. Same deal. Said, the bigger the strawberry, the better it would sell. Didn't people would come sample them? The super sweet ones didn't sell compared to the big ones. So we've really kind of gone away from common sense, because as Americans, we want bigger, better for less money. And that's what's kind of got us into this corporate greed of bastardizing our labels.
Turns out size really does matter, I guess.
It certainly does.
So, again, I'm sitting here pulling stuff up on my phone, just kind of trying to find some different topics or points here. And on USDA.gov, which is going to know what it takes to be certified organic, right? It says that it has to be produced without using most conventional pesticides, which I found interesting.
So most. That's a lot of wiggle.
That means without using 51% of conventional pesticides. That would be the majority, right?
Agreed.
Now, what if that's the actual percentage?
Don't quote me on this. I'll have to do some more research. I want to say it was 85% is...
of conventional?
It has to be 85% organic. So you can have, 15% of conventional, in order to get an organic label. I don't know that for a fact, but...
So again, though, but...
Gives you a lot of wiggle room.
If I'm going to pay, because you're paying 2 and 3 times as much comparatively, if you went, run-of-the-mill on the shelf compared to organic, I mean, it's nothing to pay twice as much for some of those products. I want somebody out there with a brush all day brushing the bugs off of that tomato. You know what I mean? If people really knew, even at 15%, that's still way too much for me to pay twice as much for a product.
Yeah.
I think that's totally out of line. If it's going to be organic, I would think that, the ground that it's harvested on would have had to have not seen pesticides for a decade, no conventional pesticides, no poisons ever put on it. The fact that they can put, to Joe's point, maybe not certain pesticides or a less percentage of those pesticides, but dump it on 10 times as often, that's asinine. That's crazy that you can get away with that and then double the price of your eggs or milk or whatever.
You got to know your farmers, guys. You got to go out and see it. If they tell you these pigs were raised with compassion or raised pasture raised, what is a pasture?
Mm-hmm.
A pasture means they're not in a building. That's they have access on what we call unfettered access to dirt. I'm not saying that that a pig in a pasture-raised pig doesn't have the opportunity for a better life, but it's certainly not a pasture-raised pig if anymore.
And
not,
what does not the always. Pasture look like?
Moreover, where is that pasture? Is it coming from another country?
Yeah.
And did it come here for 3 days before we killed it, and we called it now pasture-raised, and it was in a condition that we wouldn't allow anything to live? I mean, it's sketchy to say the least. So again, if you don't see your food and know your farmer, there are zero. You can expect zero support or zero
confidence
in where that animal was raised or how that crop was raised. Green beans, for example, they can raise them organically, but they're still going to come farm them or harvest them with commercial machinery, and those green beans show up so damn filthy that I wouldn't eat them. They're not picking them by hand like we once did. They have a big machine that comes through, and they're just dirty. You can't wash them and get them clean enough before they put them in a can. Can't do it. So, again, if you don't know the farmer, you should have no confidence.
I feel like a lot of this comes back to the food miles and just knowing where it comes from, knowing your farmer. And if you... ideally, we would like to know the farmer, or know the farm where everything comes from. I don't know that that's realistic in today's society, but at least knowing where it comes from, knowing that, you know, as we talked about the what was it, peaches and the pear juice, and we have no idea where any of that shit comes from.
None.
So as we move on here, let's kind of dive down into our last segment, and let's talk a little bit about dates. I know dates are another big thing on food labels, and that's a hot topic of discussion. We've got sell-by, we've got use-by, and we've got best if use-by. What do those things mean, and are they important to us? Are they as hard and fast as we've been taught to believe, and how do we interpret those?
Those are great questions. And I would say again, sell by, there, you know, it's pretty apparent what that one means. Sell by means that the grocer can't sell it past that date. And typically that's going to apply to fresh thing or to things that we would perceive as fresh. For example, fish, you know, sell by, because you would think that on, if it says this fish has got a 48-hour timeline from the time it hits the grocer's shelf to the time that it's going to spoil, the grocer doesn't want that, risk, so he's going to sell it by a specific date. Does that mean that it went bad? Nope, but that means it's surely suspect. Lots of people, my dad was a big fan, who bought products that were a day past expiration. My dad loved to find a deal on cheap fish. My dad also suffered from occasional colitis, and you wonder why. He loved that outdated stuff, and he also spent a great deal more time in the bathroom than the average man. So, you know, use by dates to me, when that product, we think about fish, for example, Alaskan caught salmon might go from Alaska, might be marginally processed in Canada somewhere, frozen on site, shipped to China for further processing and you know, the packaging, and shipped back to the U.S. is still frozen, and you know, and they have the ability to call it fresh or have a very fresh sell-by date. You know, the idea that we can have a factory fishing vessel that can catch fish and put it on the grocer's shelf a month later and still sell it as fresh product is concerning to me. When we think about fishing, you know, we think of hook and line, one fish right to the pan. That's a fresh fish. The fish that you buy in the grocery store may be 30 days old and still sold as fresh fish. So sell-by dates is simply something that regulates the grocer's liability. Use-by, it would be something that typically has a longer date and may go bad on in your kitchen. So that would be commonly things like produce, milk, for example, or cheese. And then best buy, I laugh at that one, you know, because as a beer drinker, we see best buy as something that lasts a little longer. You know, beer is relatively shelf stable. It may taste skunky after a year, but best buy means that it's going to degrade. It may not make you sick, but the quality isn't going to be what you suspect after that particular date.
I know we were down in the butcher room a little bit earlier before we recorded the podcast, and I think it was a good opportunity for us to talk about some freezer troubles we were having. Long story short, we butchered on, what was it, Saturday, got everything put in the freezer to kind of get it flash frozen. I went down last night and took a look and realized that, hey, it's not frozen, but it was refrigerated, so we were still at 35 degrees. So, Bo, do you want to talk a little bit about that and some of the conversation that we had there?
So I think for one thing, that I think the listeners need to understand, whenever we talk about the butcher room, this is not a corner of a garage that we're just labeling a butcher room. Joe has a legit, fully functional butcher facility. So when we're talking about that, whenever we say we put it in the freezer, this is a large commercial flash freezer that we were able to single stack every single piece of meat from an entire beef in. So we're not talking about a Lowe's, you know, deep freezer. That
not a chest freezer we bought at Walmart.
This is a big commercial item. And, you know, the last time we butchered pigs, what's a couple months ago now?
Yeah.
Something like that. And whenever we plugged it in and let it, you know, pre-cool, it wasn't dropping to the temperature that Joe wanted it to. So we tore into it, tried to figure out what was going on, and where the fan and the coils would be on the inside of the freezer was a solid chunk of ice. So we spent some time, thawed that out, chunked all the ice out of it, and, you know, it was able to cool down. It cools down to like negative 20 or something.
It's way cold.
Way low. So, again, you know, knowing that, between Pig Butcher and Beef Butcher, we probably should have plugged it in for a little test. But as we do, we didn't. We plugged it in on Butcher Day. And I got, you know, a call today that said, hey, we're going to have to get the beef out of the flash freezer and into everybody's personal freezers so it can get frozen. Now, when I showed up, my first question to Joe was, are we still okay to eat this? Like, and it only got, so, I mean, we're talking about 35 to 40 degrees, you know, instead of negative 20. We're in the 35 to 40 degree range, let's say. And my upbringing was that, you know, meat can only stay, you know, out in the fridge for a certain amount of time. So I had a concern that, you know, our meat might be bad because it wasn't down to that freezing, you know, temperature. It was, you know, bordering on refrigerator temperature, I would guess. You know, I think refrigerators are going to run in that, you know,
high 30s.
High 30 range. So we refrigerated it for, this is Wednesday.
So 4 days?
Yeah, 4 days. 4 days that we had it in a refrigerator. And Joe took some time to explain that to me. And whenever we kill a beef, we always let it hang for a minimum of 10 days. And that's our minimum. Longer than that's great. But that's in the cooler, which, you know, keeps it at that 35 to 40 degree range. So really all we've done is take it from 35 to 40 degrees now and move it, you know, sliced, cut, whatever, further processed, as Joe was talking about other stuff, you know, we further processed it and put it back into a 35 to 40 degree temperature. So, you know, that eased my concerns by a lot. I can tell you my wife's at home right now cooking up some of the beef because I wanted to eat some of it before it was ever even frozen out. I think there's something to be said there. Had it not kind of been an accidental check, it, you know, who's to say that it could have been 60 degrees and then we would have lost entire beef. So, you know, when you're doing that kind of stuff, you know, making sure that you're checking on it and, you know, it gets down to frozen so you can store that stuff is really important to keep your meat fresh. But luckily we're in good shape. The flash freezer at least held it to refrigerator temperature for us, so we're all in good shape.
Joe, if you want to talk a little bit here, I want to talk specifically about food miles in this scenario and how that has bought us some saving grace. Because had I gone and bought steaks at the grocery store and put them in a freezer that wasn't was refrigerated temperature, I could have lost those because those steaks at the grocery store are much older than what we butchered Saturday. So we've got a little bit of grace there. So can you talk a little bit to that?
Well, I just think that it's really important that as producers, you know, going back to the 100-yard meal, that we look as producers, that we look at where our food is and how it'll get there. So the average restaurant, when I say an average restaurant, let me back up. A really high-end restaurant is going to serve a 45-day age steak. And that means they've killed it and skinned it and hung it, cut it, put it in a cooler, and let it sit there for 45 days before they cut it again and throw it on a grill. So, you know, if they've got 45 days on it at a cool temperature, that's not frozen, that's just cool. If they've got 45 days on it and their cooler goes out, it's not going to last very long at all. And when you, the shorter the food miles, you know, when our cooler started bumping up, we checked it out and it said, hey, it's not 20 below now, it's 30, 35. we had time to react. So it makes it a far safer product, provided that our kill facility is cleaner and that we're practicing what we call GMP, good management practices, and that we're washing our hands and we're wearing our gloves, or we're sanitizing and cleaning up afterwards. We need to understand that, a dirty abattoir can be as dangerous as a commercial facility. In fact, in most cases, you'll get less instances of salmonella or listeria from a big facility that you will from a poorly run home facility. But we go to extreme lengths to make sure that our meat is clean and that we're feeding our family the very best product we can. So when the cooler does go out, we've got some latitude.
Does that have a lot to do with like chemical usage and bigger, commercial facility type stuff?
I think that's a good question for Tyler. We talked about this earlier, and he had a great understanding having worked in a commercial kill facility.
So one of the things, I used to work in a commercial chicken processing plant. They use a shitload of chemicals to keep the facility clean. One of the chemicals they use is called PAA, or parasitic acid, and it kills salmonella and campylobacter, and it's a kind of a fungicide, kind of a antimicrobial is the word I'm looking for. That's one thing that we used, and we produce some really clean chicken. With that, I was in that facility in a working in the healthcare field, so I dealt with injuries and sickness and all kinds of things like that in that facility. With that PAA, that chemical is so volatile and so irritating and toxic to humans that I would see we're talking 10 to 15 employees a day that are having respiratory issues, they're having eye issues, they're having all kinds of issues because this chemical is so volatile and it off-gasses so much that it was just hard to work around, and it was making the employees sick. So PAA is an approved chemical to put in a chiller, and Joe can speak a little bit to this and maybe have some more numbers on this. But when you take a chicken, when you process chicken, there's a hot process and there's a cold process. So the hot process is where we pluck the feathers, we pull out all the entrails and the guts and that kind of thing. Then those birds are washed in a PAA solution. And then they go into a giant vat of water, and that water is a PAA solution. So as those chickens move across that chiller, they bring them down to a cool temperature, a refrigerated temperature, but those chickens are absorbing that water and they're absorbing that PAA. What's the weight difference in a chicken pre-chiller and post-chiller?
33%.
33. So a third of that bird, a third of that final weight of that bird is that water and that PAA that is absorbed in that chiller.
It's not absorbed into it, though. We need to be common that there's paddles in there that pushes that water. It beats that water, and water is a relative term. It's a liquid. Let's back up. There's some water in it, but it's a liquid that we use to chill the birds and to sanitize the birds, and there's paddles in there that bumps that bird around like an agitator in a washing machine that pushes that liquid into that bird. So it goes in looking like the little skinny rubber chicken you buy at a novelty store, and it comes out looking like the giant breasted bird that you see.
So with that, yes, the chemicals keep it cleaner. There's no salmonella there. There's no campylobacter there. Very clean facility. But on the flip side of that coin, working on the healthcare side of that plant, seeing what those chemicals do to the employees who are exposed to them really makes me question whether or not I want to eat that bird. There's a lot of concern there for me personally.
As you should be concerned, and I think as we all are concerned, my wife fought and beat breast cancer, and we live a fairly... We live a fairly holistic lifestyle. We grow an awful lot, and we're not purists. We don't eat 100% of what we grow, but we do eat out on occasion. But my wife still fought and beat breast cancer, and you have to ask, where did that come from? You know, I always like to talk about one of an author that I love, and it's one of the pillars in this lifestyle that I live. But there's a farmer from Georgia named Will Harris, and Will Harris has a term that we used in the Army. Our Army term was,
yep,
and that means fucked up beyond recognition. And Will Harris will tell you that is the nature of these labels on our food. It just doesn't matter, guys.
I don't know that, especially coming out of this episode, I don't know that it's worth even looking at a label anymore.
It's not.
Well, I've been doing it right all along, fellas.
Touché.
Well, as we move on, I think we're kind of ready to wrap up this episode. Some of the key points, Bo, what was your big takeaway from today as we talk about food labels?
Well, so I learned a lot about them, and I didn't talk about this anywhere in the podcast, but I think it kind of goes into what we're talking about here a little bit. So we watched the movie Dark Waters this week, and I don't know if either one of you guys have seen that, and it's around the same time frame. Off recording, we were talking about a lady named Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring that Joe read whenever he was very little, that kind of started the movement in the EPA. And Dark Waters is all about that specific time in the United States and the world where somebody came in and said, we're going to have to start regulating some stuff. Things hadn't been regulated up to that point. It was... I don't remember what they called it, but it was basically saying that if the consumer wanted to buy the product, it was on them to know exactly what was in it. Like it was the Wild West of
buyer beware kind of us.
So the EPA came in, but what I found really interesting in this movie was at that time, what they basically did, and what a lot of people don't really know about is whenever new laws are enacted, a large majority of the time is anything before that day is grandfathered in. So there was a company, and it was DuPont at that time, that a lot of their stuff was just grandfathered in under this new initiative of, you know, we've got to actually know what's in there. And at, you know, going through this movie, it was all about this farmer and, you know, he was having cattle born with, you know, two heads and, you know, couldn't walk and, you know, basically went mad. You know, they went from being his pets that he could go out and play with to just being absolutely crazy. And they ended up, you know, all of his cattle died. Him and his wife both ended up with a cancer, and they lived next to one of DuPont's dumps is basically what it was. And they were burying these 55-gallon drums of what is now known as C8, which is what's in Teflon, that is still in stuff today, keep in mind. They won, you know, and it was about this lawyer, like all the other movies, you know, it was about a lawyer that felt bad for the farmer and took on his case, and, you know, they did battle with DuPont. And, you know, the settlement was huge, but we didn't change much. We said, yeah, we totally believe that you got cancer from this. We totally believe that this killed all your cattle. We totally believe that you're getting ready to die because of what, you know, is in this. But they're making a whole, you know, butt ton of money and padding somebody's pockets, so we're just going to let it go. And it came up at the end of the movie, and I hope I get the percentage right, but they said, because at the time, like, this same product, it was used in the carpets, you know, and everything. Like, this was all around you. But at the end of it, they think that somewhere around 98% of all the people in the world have a certain amount of C8 in their bodies that they have taken in because of all that. So, you know, they sold it because eggs slid out of the pan really nice and pretty. And I think that goes along with what we've been talking about is, you know, don't trust them. You know, cast iron skillet is a cast iron skillet, and it's been a cast iron skillet for a long time. So, you know, I think being aware of those things, again, I wasn't a label reader, but, you know, things I'm going to look for is how few of ingredients are actually in the can. I think that's a good place to start. And, you know, learn about stuff from there. The non-GMO thing that Joe was telling us about is really surprising to me. I had no idea that people were just putting pretty stickers on there that didn't mean shit.
They don't.
I'm glad you mentioned cast iron because, you know, Teflon pans are nice and they cook a pretty egg.
Yep.
I had a conversation with Dad earlier today and we were talking about cast iron. And I said, you know what? I pulled cast iron out of scrap heaps, hit it with a wire wheel, and it'll cook a pretty damn egg too.
Yep.
Teflon pan, I don't know that I've ever owned one more than 6 months that hasn't ended up scratched up and
flaking
and where are those flakes going? They're ended up in your food.
In your scrambled eggs.
And we think about, you know, I'm going to have to watch that Dark Waters movie because it sounds really interesting. And I feel like a lot of us think, well, I don't live next to a DuPont plant, but for all three of us here, we don't live far from Verona, Missouri, and Verona is a super fun site, and they had all kinds of chemicals, and there's still people that are having cancers and all kinds of health issues. And, you know, that's 7 miles up the road that you don't have to live next to a DuPont facility to see the effects of these chemicals and the crap that we're dumping into our ground and into our water sources. We're really not as far removed from these things as we think we are. Joe, what are some key points that you've taken away from today?
Well, I suppose it's just a reassurance that you guys are thinking the way I do. And guys, for you listeners out there, much of what we do is conversational. We don't script this. We don't plan it. We have some general ideas of what we want to talk about. But all of these podcasts are just three guys having a cocktail and talking about what's important to us. So as a lifelong food producer, my takeaway today is that I have reassurance from both of you that my thinking is correct. And I feel validated and I feel strong that we need to continue this message and we have to multiply our efforts through others. So I hope that our listeners will, you know, give us a ring, call us and maybe grow some of their own food. You know, we can't guarantee that it's going to be a healthy lifestyle, but we can guarantee that it'll be a healthier lifestyle. You know, even if you just throw away your Teflon pans or grow your beets. Today we grew some beets, by the way. We harvested some beets that were beautiful and we know where they came from. I'll pickle them. My wife will enjoy them and I'll feel proud that I fed her something that didn't come from a commercial operation. You know, the worst thing that could be on our beets is maybe some cow poop, which isn't necessarily bad for the beet anyway.
It washes off pretty easy.
Correct.
We definitely want you guys to think about food labels next time you're at the grocery store. Take a look at them. Think about some of the things that we've discussed and, you know, share your thoughts with us. What are some things that you're feeling when you walk through the grocery store aisle? When you walk through Walmart, do you feel like you've been duped? And if you don't, maybe think about it a little bit more and maybe wonder if you should.
Come by the farm and visit.
We appreciate you guys listening. We would love to have you guys out here at the farm. We would love to hear your feedback. We're getting a little bit of traction now. We're getting some more listener engagement, and it's really been good for us. It helps us identify what you guys want to hear and what we need to talk about. We appreciate you guys. Make sure that you're looking us up on Facebook. Like and follow our page. Keep up with us. Share your thoughts, comments, concerns, questions on any of our posts, anything that kind of provokes you to ask a question. One of the greatest pieces of advice I ever heard was never stop asking why. So whether you're looking at our post on Facebook, ask why. If you're looking at a can of pinto beans that says non-GMO, ask yourself why. And hopefully, together with us, we can answer some of those questions. And that's it for today's episode of Farm Foundations. We hope you found our discussion on common label claims in the grocery helpful.
And like Tyler said, if you have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes, don't hesitate to reach us on social media or through our website.
That's right. And please be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. It means a lot to us. We've got new and exciting topics lined up for future episodes, and I don't think you'll want to miss them.
Thank you all for tuning in. And until next time, happy homesteading.